This is an interview with Governor Victor Attia at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is June 15th, 1993, and this is Tape 36, Side 1. Just off tape, you were mentioning about the things in a campaign that aren't seen.
Yeah.
What is not seen?
Really, the difficult work of addresses, phone numbers, purging tax rolls, addressing envelopes, phone banks, where they're going to be, getting volunteers to cover it.
Are you dealing with those kinds of things in your campaign, or are those all
I am not, no. Mm-hmm. But I tell you, it was a real joy, really a joy. We had teams of people who would come in, and they were having a good time. It wasn't a drudgery thing for them. They enjoyed each other. I really would love it when I come back to my headquarters, and I knew most of them, and we'd chat, and they're just having a good time. If there's a birthday, there's a cake out there. The guy that was doing our mailing, you know, these are all volunteers. Just having themselves a good time at some very difficult work. Tedious, I should say. Planning a campaign. Where you're going to go. When are you going to go there? Getting the right organization in the counties. Again, you don't do everything at your headquarters. Mm-hmm. The phone banks take place in Wallowa County and Curry County and Multnomah County. You know, these are all over the place. To work in tandem with your county organization, with whatever they had going. When can you get there? How long can you stay? How do you get there? Are you going to fly? Who's going to fly you?
How closely would you work with the Republican Party campaign organizations?
The Republican Party as such, very little. Uh-huh. Very little.
Doesn't it make it harder to not have a party structure to fall back on?
The party can help you an awful lot, but they can't. It's very difficult for them to get directly involved in campaigns. But they can use some of their own volunteers. Mm-hmm. We get volunteers from them. Just before an election, I'm a precinct committee man. You get campaign material of different candidates, and you walk your precinct and just leave things or knock on doors. And you don't really do that much campaigning for the candidate, but we'd like to have you have this. that's how the party can help. But your organization is your organization. It's not the party organization, the formal party organization. It's your own. You have your own county chairman who makes your schedule for you. I think I did cover this, but yeah, I did with Norm Smith, where my chairman down there, Norm Smith, went down and he just had this long list of stops to make. I can't do that. And my chairman said, Victor Tia does this all the time. And that's what I would do. And that's you just have to keep going. But nobody sees any of that.
You said this before about all these stops that you'd make in one day or one weekend or one trip. And since you've said that, I've been imagining in my mind if I had how many. Was how long was the list? Did you say 65 or something like that? How many stops?
We just did stops like just.
Well, how would you relax? How would you not drain yourself when you were going through that?
Well, you don't notice it. You get awful tired, but you don't notice it. There is an exhilaration about campaigning if you like people.
Yeah.
There's a real exhilaration to it. I would sleep very well at night, although sometimes rather short, you know, late at night, early morning kind of thing. But you don't really know it. You're in it, and you go through it. And whatever your high is, it keeps you there, and you keep going at it. Mm-hmm. Although I will admit that sometimes in the morning when I'm shaving, I'm saying to myself, what the hell are you doing? But that wouldn't last too long. Uh-huh. You just keep going. And the energy of the volunteers that you meet, the people that you see, you know they're working hard for you. You know, you just kind of keep going for because you believe in what you're doing, and they believe in you.
How much did Dolores participate in the campaigning?
Well, she, you know, she would, she was very good, and she participated, and not just with me, although sometimes we'd be together. I used to kid an awful lot, saying that they'd try to get Dolores, and if they couldn't get her, they'd take me, because she was very good on the stuff. She liked people. She would get a little more determined about me and how good I am than I would about myself. but she was very good at it, and she was a participant in the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Another issue on the during this election was ballot measure number 3. It was the attempt to limit property tax increases to 15% of true cash value.
Yeah, another 1.5. Yeah,
and you opposed. You opposed that, but you did favor some form of limit, didn't you?
Yeah, always did. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that. And my approach was limiting the increase and giving tax bases to those wherever they had to be. Mm-hmm. The 1.5% was laying a single lid over an irregular top. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's probably the easiest way to explain it. I hadn't done it that way before.
And another issue, and I remember reading a lot about this at the time, was the issue of relief from long-term federal timber sales contracts.
Yes.
Maybe you could explain a little bit about
the
that.
The timber industry did use some bad judgment. Mm-hmm. And in those days, if you got a public timber contract for harvesting, you had 5 years in which to harvest it. That was a normal period of time. And again, you have to remember those times, particularly at times that inflation was going up. Someone could buy a timber sale today and pay too much for it. By the time it came to harvest, it was cheap. The stumpage had gone up. Mm-hmm. So everybody was betting on the come. They say, okay, we can afford to pay too much for it today because tomorrow it's going to be cheap. Well, when the recession came along, all of a sudden here they were with $400, $450, $500 a thousand stumpage that they had bid for, but now the price had gone down to $200. Actually, it even got under 100 at one point.
Really?
Yes. And here they are with this contract that clearly they're going to go out of business. So there had been a long attempt to try to get the Forest Service to revalue these contracts. It was, I have to tell you, a good thing for the businesses, the timber companies, but in terms of the state and my interest in survival, that if we didn't do that, they're gone. And obviously, it wasn't a matter of saving them, Frank Smith, Joe Johnson, or whoever. It wasn't a matter of saving them. It was a matter of saving them to save the jobs. So it took quite a bit of time. Finally, the federal government did. They did do that.
There was a lot of opposition to that, and some of that opposition came from southern lumbermen and Idaho pine foresters, who said that would give the Northwest an undue competitive advantage.
Well, that's again self-interest kind of thing, particularly in the South. I'm talking about Georgia and, mm-hmm. and the Carolinas and that part of the world, because they didn't have the same kind of situation. See, down there, there's not public timber. Down there, it's all private ownership. They didn't have the same kind of a situation that we had here. And so they had a real strong advantage over us. The matter of fact, the southern timber market had sopped up an awful lot of the market for the Northwest lumber. So that strictly was just a self-interest thing. We don't want these guys to get off the hook. We really want to kill off the timber industry in Oregon.
What about the Idaho situation, Idaho Pine Foresters?
They were sort of a, let me call aberration, they're just all by themselves. Mm-hmm. They had their own timber and they didn't really care one way or another. And they had an advantage, and obviously it would be to their advantage, that the Northwest, now I'm saying Oregon and Washington, those operators would go south. So they were the opponents to that kind of a setup. I want to jump ahead because it did take place. It was revalued. It did save a lot of jobs and a lot of companies. Then times got better, and I was telling some of my friends in the industry, you better not start doing this all over again. That is bidding high. They did reduce the time for harvest to 3 years, which was, I think, a good step to start with. Because now you can't bet 5 years in advance, you got to bet 3 years in advance, and that's good too. But I said, you better not do that again, because you can't go to that well two times. You've gone to it once and you'll never go to it again. So if you're going to do it, you don't look to any government to get you off the hook.
Well, there was a quote saying that you were appalled at what you considered the Reagan administration's superficial understanding of government-induced plight of Oregon timber industry. Mm-hmm. Is that really, did you really feel appalled by their understanding?
Yeah. But I say Reagan because he was president at the time. I really objected to the federal, Washington, D.C. management of Northwest timber. Mm-hmm. I really did, and I have a speech that I wrote in which, actually, some people laughed at it, but to me I was deadly serious. In that the state of Oregon Department of Forestry would actually take over the management of all public timberland, because we know how to manage it. But the real tragic part was that the federal government, the way they operated generally, they would make this timber sale, and obviously the timber doesn't cost them anything, so they're making some money on the deal. No matter what they sell it for, they're going to make money on it. And then the money, however, doesn't go back to the U.S. Department of Interior, and Ag, I guess the Ag has the other part of it. There's BLM and the Forest Service. But it would go back into the general fund. So you had to get an appropriation in order to put up other sales. It ought to go into the forestry pot to reforest, to manage the forest well, to do it all very well. But it doesn't happen that way. It goes into the pot and Congress has to appropriate money again. And that's part of it. Then there's the other part that the folks back there, most of them, most congressmen and senators, really don't understand this industry. So all they get is that, their glorious view of this tree that they don't want anybody to cut down.
Somebody else here said that the crash in timber prices that left the Oregon industry stuck with high-priced federal timber contracts corresponds with the date Congress passed a bill changing the banking laws, drying up the pool of low-cost mortgage money that had been the mainstay of the nation's housing and wood products industry for more than 40 years. Mm-hmm. Was that really how it worked? Mm-hmm. I mean, those two things mm-hmm. coincided.
And if I could divert for a second, we keep hearing about the savings and loan scandal. Mm-hmm. And there was. There were crooks in that business. But I think if you'd ask anybody on the street, all SNLs are crooked people, and that's why they went broke. But that's not really what happened. And again, now we get back to, do you understand, do you have a philosophy in regard to what ought to happen in this country? I do. I believe that it's very important for home ownership. But I believe in terms of home ownership because I believe people ought to take care of themselves and prepare for their retirement, not depend on the government for retirement. And I go back to the time way back when I was starting as a young man in business and people were coming to sell me life insurance. It seems so ludicrous today, but I buy a $10,000 policy, which was a big policy, I mean, for me. And so your agent would tell you, well, you know, when you get to be 65, this is how much you can get out of it. And if you have several policies, and I've seen charts, and this is how much you're going to get it when you become 65. And Social Security was almost a throw-in. You know, oh, and in addition, you'll get this. So Social Security was just a throw-in. Today, Social Security is the big thing. It's the main thing. It's the only important thing. Now let me get back to where I am. If you own a home, or you want to buy a home, it's really like making a deposit in the bank. Because every time you make a payment on your home, you basically have a little bit more ownership in that house. It took me 25 years to pay off a mortgage. I finally paid it off. And so what I have now, for whatever the value of my home is, that's like my savings account. I've done that. So you need to make home ownership, in my way of thinking, a realistic possibility. During all these years, SNL, Savings and Loan Industry, their niche was to provide loans for homes for people. Mm-hmm. Banks, they were the commercial lenders. SNLs had 20, 25-year mortgages. Banks had 1, 2, 3-year short-term loans. But that was the field. Mm-hmm. There was also a law that restricted the interest you could pay. With SNLs, I think it was 4.5%. Incidentally, I was on a board of a savings and loan for 16 years, so I'm talking from that perspective. 4.5%. Nobody could pay more than that. Banks, for any savings account, is less than a SNL could pay. But effectively what was happening, because there was a cap on the interest that could be paid, is that all Americans were subsidizing home ownership. They were subsidized in the sense that they, you know, maybe put money somewhere else and get more interest on it, but there was a cap on it. Okay, I'll put it in SNL. Then the SNLs got that money. Now that's no different than a pack of chewing gum. You buy it for 5 cents and you sell it for 7.5 cents. You make 2.5 cents. So they'd buy money, an SNL, for 4.5% or 4% or whatever it is. That's what they'd buy money for. Mm-hmm. And therefore they could sell it to me for 6 or 6.5%. That was their profit. And I'll convert that. Let's say 6%. 6% would double in about 15 years. That's 90, but obviously there's compounding in there. But now today it's 10% or thereabouts. So that's less than 10 years. In other words, if you borrowed $50,000 for a home in about 8 or 9 years, you will have paid $50,000 in interest. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, what happened? They took that interest off. Everybody's now competing for money. SNLs are in real tough shape because interest rates are going up. Mm-hmm. And it's true, they could buy money now for 8% and loan it out for 9.5%. But they have all of these loans back here at 6% for 30, 25 years. And so they had trouble working out of that. That was the problem with an SNL. That's why a lot of them went broke. Mm-hmm. Banks, they could tough it out.
But then you hear these stories about people buying back the same property at 10 cents on the dollar from the government.
No. But banks could tough it out. You know, they had 1 to 2, 3 years. I mean, they had a short time frame in which to deal with that. SNLs didn't have that. I mean, that was really basically one of the problems that they had. And so, but what really happened, when you really look at it, is that it's made home ownership a great deal more difficult. A lot of people can't even get their starter home, and a lot of people aren't putting money aside for their future.
But people in Oregon looked at the savings loan situation here as being substantially different than it was in other parts of the country, like California and Texas. And even though they suffered through their own recessions, we suffered through a pretty bad recession here, and we didn't go through the same types of savings and loans disasters that they did. And the federal government is basically subsidizing Texas and California as a result, not Oregon.
Well, that's true, but we had good savings and loans. They were good companies. They had the problem that I just described. Actually, the two major ones, one was Equitable Savings and Loan, of which I was a board member. The other one was Benjamin Franklin Savings and Loan. They're both gone now. They no longer exist. Mm-hmm. And they've been here. Matter of fact, Equitable has been around for 75 or 80 years. Mm-hmm. Very well, highly regarded, and very well respected. But that's really, now, you see where it finally comes down. We talk about S&Ls and banks and all the rest of it, but you see where I'm converting this to,
right,
is to something entirely different.
Yeah.
It's a matter of home ownership, and it should be possible.
And wasn't home ownership in Oregon the highest of a percentage per capita?
Oregon had a lot of home ownership, and to Oregonian it was very important, and I think that's a smart thing to do. You know, young people, they can't afford it, and so they're living in apartments, and they're not putting any aside for their future, and it's a shame. I'm sure they want to own a home. Mm-hmm. Gosh, my daughter and her husband bought a home. $140,000. You know, they're really slammed up really hard, tough against it, and it isn't. It's not half the home of mine. Not half the home of mine. But that's the unfortunate nature of what's going on around here.
One view of what was going on with the timber sale contracts was that in the early 1970s, some timber operators began bidding 2 to 3 times the appraised price at the U.S. Forest Service timber sales. And more conservative timber operators in Oregon were appalled and refused to enter the bidding. Isn't this sort of going against the free market forces by helping out people who take extreme risks and people who are more conservative actually suffering as a result?
Yeah, but it depends on who you're worried about. Mm-hmm. Are you worried about Joe Smith, who owns that sawmill? Or are you worried about the people who work for Joe Smith? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. See, I don't mind saving Joe Smith. But it's not a matter of trying to save Joe Smith. I'm trying to save the people that work for Joe Smith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people also that were relying more highly on Forest Service timber, federal timber.
That's right.
And they were in a lot deeper trouble than the people that had some private holdings.
That's right.
But the more conservatively managed companies that bought only a few of the high-priced federal sales are blending their expensive federal timber with cheaper state and local government timber sales and trees cut from their own land.
Exactly right.
The Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, John Crowell Jr., suggested that the free market force should be allowed to work its will, but that would cause the suffering you're saying of a lot of workers. That
yeah, you know, it's one thing to hew closely to when we talk about free enterprise and all the rest, but there are times in which, you know, I believe in it. I probably believe in it more than almost anyone. And you have to if you're a small retailer. That's the last bastion of what I really call genuine free enterprise. Nobody really cares if a retailer goes out of business. As a matter of fact, they applaud it because now you've got a going out of business sale. Really, you know, the world I came from is really free enterprise, and yet here I am. I'm in a state that has unemployment at 12.6%. I'm calling a press conference for a company that's going to hire 40 people Mm-hmm. Well, they wonder what the heck, you know, 40 people, what are you calling a press conference for? To me, it was very exciting. I'm trying to save every single job I can. That's why today I'm appalled that Governor Roberts and previous to that, Governor Goldschmidt, could be so casual about 30, 35, 40,000 timber jobs going away. Mm-hmm. I cannot be that casual. I can't. Even today, I can't be that casual about it. But they were, well, we'll just retrain these people. Again, the tape didn't get right. Rolled to the eyes.
Another issue that came up during the campaign was in August, the Washington County Public Affairs Forum, where you were defending a plan to balance the state's latest budget deficit of $87 million by tapping the Safe Corporation for $81 million. Uh-huh. And in September, then you, in September 82, you appointed investigators to probe allegations that five part-time Safe board members acted improperly, and urged that the board appoint someone other than the Safe president, Charles Gill Jr., to deal with the various investigations. The probe was urged by Safe board chairman Leroy Livermore.
Livermore.
Why were you going about it that way, trying to tap Safe for the $81 million?
I know I mentioned this before. Well, first to answer your question, why? That incidentally, back to campaign. You have to learn to answer the question in as short a way as possible. I spent quite a bit of time, and I talked to the Attorney General's office, even had Chuck Gill, incidentally, who was then the one that we were referring to a moment ago.
Right.
And the theory behind what we were doing is that the state put in some money to begin SAFE. SAFE, at this later point, as you recall, we talked about that, became a quasi-independent insurance company. And my contention was that the state was getting back some of the money that we put in. That was the basic theory of why we were suggesting that we take that money. That if indeed they would have been paying taxes, they would have paid a lot, like all other insurance companies, would have paid a lot more taxes than even what I was asking for. At the same time, we looked at the surplus. They had a huge surplus, huge surplus. And so I said, okay, we can do that. We can balance our budget, and that will not hurt SAFE. Okay, that's the background for everything yet now to come. Obviously, there were counterarguments. You know, you're taking our money away. Now I'm talking about the employers. Because they were getting dividends from SAFE, businesses were. Incidentally, businesses never got a dividend, ever, until the three-way workers' comp bill passed. Mm-hmm. Never. But anyway, now it became a normal routine of giving dividends. The question is, how much dividend would they have gotten? And then you look at the history of SAFE, and obviously they never gave away all the surplus. They kept some of the surplus, which is a good business practice, incidentally. It's not wrong. And so the question is, how much would they've gotten? Then finally I said, this is not the best answer, but this is the best of all the bad answers. And it was. I never contended this was the finest thing that ever happened, ever. But we had gone through 1980 in budget cuts. We'd gone through, now this is the third special session in 1 year. We'd gone through all the cuts that we could possibly go through. And I just said, look, this we can't go through anymore. We've done everything we can. We've raised all the revenue we can. We've cut all the budgets that we can. And so this is not the greatest one, but it's the best of all the bad ones. This is bad, but this is the best of the bad. But this was the most controversial thing. And incidentally, you know, if somebody's really worried and saying things during the course of a campaign because you're trying to protect your rear end, here I am in September. Mm-hmm. In September. And we're only 2 months away from election, coming up with that. Now, okay, if I was really watching out for my tail, I'd try to find something else. Cuts.